Welcome back to Offworld, the show where we talk about all things space exploration and pop culture. I'm Ariel Waldman.
And I'm Norm Chan. Well, unlike in previous episodes, we're not going to be diving into a piece of science fiction or even a trope. We're going to talk about history today.
Yeah, I'm actually really fangirling because our guest today is Frances Poppy Northcutt. She was the very first woman to work in mission control at NASA and has a really, really captivating, interesting story about her time working in Apollo and her life since then. I'm so ecstatic to have her in the studio today.
Her story, as well as some other folk stories, are being surfaced right now as we get closer to the 50th anniversary of the moon landing. And there's a documentary on National Geographic called Apollo Missions to the Moon, in which she's featured. So she's here to talk to us about Apollo.
So I'm really excited to have you in the studio today. Poppy, please introduce yourself and a bit about what you worked on during the Apollo missions and what you've been working on since.
Well, back during the Apollo missions, I was a return to Earth specialist. So my job was to bring the astronauts back to the Earth from the moon. And most of that work was done in advance in the design of a large computer program that computed trajectories.
Yeah. Well, so we're now at the 50th anniversary of the Apollo 11 landing. What are your feelings generally now that we're 50 years into this kind of historic event?
Well, it reminds me how old I am, for one thing. I go, my goodness, I can't believe it's been 50 years. I was 25 at the time. I'm 75 now. On the one hand, it's a very exciting thing to see, especially some of the documentaries that have been coming out, to see this archival footage. You get to experience this stuff in a way that you couldn't even experience it at the time. And that's very exciting. At the same time, it's a little disappointing whenever you think about what we were doing, where we were doing, this incredible technological advance that we made 50 years ago, and then we basically have stalled since then.
Was there a sense back then, after the success of 11, that momentum would keep going? Obviously, we had, you know, the 11, the 12 to 17, and the whole program. But even in the documentary, we saw footage of Apollo 12, and already it seemed like there was less interest in the public.
It was immediate. The interest in it dropped off incredibly. The funding dropped off incredibly. It was pretty obvious very quickly that things were going to phase down very rapidly.
Wow. How do you feel, you know, you've had a really fascinating life at both in Apollo and what you've worked on afterwards. How do you feel this time that you experienced in your 20s working on the Apollo missions, like, shaped you for better or worse?
Well, it definitely shaped me, and I hope for better rather than for worse. Women at that time were existing in a sea of sexism. It was very much the bad men era. And that experience awakened my interest in ending discrimination. I became very conscious of the discrimination against women. And quite frankly, in many ways, I experienced less of the discrimination against women, or at least that was my feeling, than most women did. I was just more aware of it, partly because I was more visible. I was asked more questions about it. And because of that, I became more involved. So it definitely shaped my life. I went on to work as an activist in the National Organization for Women. I ended up on the mayor's staff at one point, working to improve the status of women. Then I went to law school. Ever since then, I have always done something, one way or the other, to work on improving women's rights. When I was a lawyer, I worked for the DA's office at one time. I was the first felony prosecutor in the domestic violence unit as it was being set up. I've always tried to do something.
Yeah. How do you feel about the space workforce today? In some ways, you know, so I've worked at NASA on and off for a few years. And in some ways, it feels like some things have changed, and other ways, it hasn't. How do you feel about where the workforce is now for people who are working in space, and then maybe where it should go?
Well, I see vast improvements in terms of just the numbers of women that are in technical roles, and that's a big improvement. At the same time, I'm aware statistically that the representation of women in computer science has gone down, and there's been some really troubling stuff that has gone on in the computer science area. So it's definitely a mixed bag.
Yeah. Yeah, it's been something that for me has been interesting to see with the rise of commercial space exploration, because commercial space companies have less restrictions put on them about who they can hire than NASA does. And yet NASA still has a better, certainly gender ratio than a lot of the commercial companies. So it's something that is interesting to look and see what was happening 50 years ago and sort of apply it to today. And I think that was something that was really that stuck out in the documentary, was getting to hear about sort of the how, because everything in this documentary is through the lens of reports at the time. So you kind of get to see how it was portrayed at the time, and you kind of get to analyze how much you know now, for instance, with the release of movies like Hidden Figures and things of that nature.
Well, and you mentioned right now that NASA has better representation of women than the contractors do. I think it's entirely possible that back 50 years ago, the contractors may have had better representation mm-hmm. of women than NASA did. Mm-hmm. At least that was what I saw. And even then, it was pretty miserable when you're talking about women in technical roles. I met a woman two or three nights ago who graduated with a math degree from the University of Texas at the same time I did, went looking for a job in Houston, and she said she interviewed with more than 20 companies and only had one job offer from IBM.
Wow.
And, you know, that was not a tight market. Apparently it was a tight market for women if you were in tech, but it wasn't a tight market at all for men at that time in Houston.
This is Betty Rogge reporting for Channel 7's Total News at the Apollo News Center in Cocoa Beach, Florida. I'd like for you to meet one of the ladies involved in the space program. This is Mary Driver. She's in personnel. Mary, tell us, how important are the women in this program?
I think the women are very important in the space program. They're involved in almost all phases, from the clerical, professional, administrative. We even have quite a few women engineers.
I think the first mission that I worked on, Apollo 8, I got a little nervous. Mainly it was being keyed up. You were excited, and everyone was very excited. But I think that you are capable of functioning. We practice so much, so many times, that the real missions almost seem easy compared to some of the simulations.
How does it feel to work among so many men in a world that is dominated by men, isn't it?
Well, it's actually dominated by computers and by machinery as a whole.
I also find it super interesting, like, the structure of this documentary is just through the lens of media. So even though it spotlights you as, you know, being the first woman in mission control, they show just the footage of the interviewers. And it was very clear at the time the approach those interviewers took. And you were very cognizant of it as well.
Yes.
With the answers you gave. And so, you know, it's kind of this double-edged sword of, like, bringing this awareness out, but again, through the lens of this Mad Men era back then. Do you find that because there's a lot more coverage of Apollo 11 now at the 50th anniversary, we see, like, Twitter threads and people reports about you, like, the media is better about that now?
Yes, the media is definitely better about it. But the media at that time, it was very sexist. In fact, you know, a lot of times people were asking me about the discrimination at NASA, and the truth of the matter is the worst sexism was out of the media.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
By far.
Yeah.
But what they don't tell you, and you should be reminded of when looking at that, is it was not until 1971 that the National Press Club admitted women. So maybe that might be a clue about the degree of sexism in the media itself.
It was just a little ahead of that time. Yeah, I mean, so there's, I mentioned Hidden Figures, but there's been a kind of a resurgence of, there's, you know, things now in, I guess, in product culture also of like, there's a Lego set of women at NASA. And I feel that there's at least some awareness now in popular media that there have been all these faces and stories from the Apollo program, but even leading up to today that are you know, sort of at least coming back. What are your thoughts on the fact that there's some momentum to recognize the fact that there's a lot of people and stories that, that got left out of these historical events? Like, do you feel we're like headed in the right direction or that there's, I don't know, a lot more awareness building that needs to be brought about the sort of people that worked on these programs?
Well, I'm heartened to see more diversity being covered. And also just a recognition of how many people were involved. At the time of the program itself, I mean, most people seemed to think that there was this little room that they would see on TV, and then there were the astronauts, and they were pretty oblivious to all of the rest, when in fact there were something like 400,000 people that were working on those programs. It was an immense team effort, probably the largest team effort we've had in our history, where we had people, you know, there were people all over the world working on that program. There were people on Ascension Island doing tracking, for example, and every one of them was important.
Yeah, I think we do see a little bit, just a glimpse of that, right, into the hangars where some of the technicians were, and in showing among this the just the reactions for the landing. What I also love is that you said it a little bit where even through the lens of this documentary, you saw glimpses of things that at the time you had no idea were going on around the world. Is that something that, as this footage is being dug up, that you like excites you and or opens your eyes toward anything?
Well, I just think it provides people with an incredible opportunity to experience what was happening at that time. And in a way that really better than you would have experiencing it at that time. When I was looking, if I was looking at public media at the time, I mean, I would be looking at it on a TV set about 11 inches that was black and white, really poor quality. And now you're getting to see this incredible archival footage, a lot of times on really big screens too. And the audio is also amazing that they've dug up, as well as all these video things that they've gotten.
I think it is something we take for granted these days with social media, just the shared reaction around mm-hmm. the world. And in that sense, like watching, I was like, okay, this is what that would have been like if we had the kind of interconnectivity of social media mm-hmm. 50 years ago. People share the reactions where people were at that moment, but it really isn't until someone does the work of pulling the footage and compiling it that you get to see that.
Yeah, I feel like we got like a tiny taste of that for the millennials when the Mars Curiosity mm-hmm. lander landed on, yeah. I think, 2012. And you got to see Times Square and you got to see everyone having all their laptops open to the landing and everything. What about space exploration thrills you generally, like for you personally? Like what aspects of space exploration get you excited?
Well, I love seeing all of it going on. I love seeing the interplanetary work that JPL is doing. And I hope that we will go back to the moon and go on to Mars. Very much hope that. I'm not real optimistic, to be honest, but I still have my hopes.
Yeah. I mean, to me, something that was interesting that we touched on earlier was that, you know, you have the Apollo 11, you have the landing, you have the big thrill, and everyone's like, you know, crying and out of happiness. And then you see it sort of wane with Apollo 12, but then Apollo 13 happens, at which you got involved in and helping get them back. Like, what was that like for you? And how do you feel like Apollo 13 changed I guess, how people felt about Apollo in the long run.
Well, I think that it really came home to them that this was not a given that you were going to be successful. We had gone through a terrible disaster on the pad with Apollo 1, but it's amazing how quickly the public can sort of forget. And you see the success, you know, you saw Apollo 7 as a success, and then 8 is a success, and then 9 and 10 and 11, the big, you know, hype on all of that, and 12, and it seems like everything, this is just cool and easy, nothing to it. And then suddenly you have 13. And it really brought home to people that this is a dangerous occupation.
Yeah. What, you know, a lot of times Apollo 13, I feel, gets portrayed not only as the danger that was involved, but also sort of the ingenuity, the creativity. You know, how did it feel like a very creative endeavor? You're, on one hand, you're dealing with something so dangerous and so serious. On the other hand, that's really when, you know, NASA and a lot of the teams there, I feel, got to sort of showcase how smart they can be when put in a bad situation, to be frank.
I actually felt that in many ways Apollo 13 was the most successful of the Apollo missions. Even though it didn't carry through the mission objectives, it demonstrated that we could recover from a really disastrous event. And I thought that was really impressive. The thing that I worked on, the return to Earth thing, a lot of times people think, oh, well, that must have been really difficult. The truth of the matter is our program did exactly what it was supposed to do. We had simulated in advance, going back, I suppose, to Apollo 10, using the descent and the ascent engines, using these multiple configurations, that was what ended up being used to come back from Apollo 13. So for us, it was stressful in the sense that we knew how bad things were, and because we had a lot of unknowns, no one knew how bad the damage was, for example. But we knew exactly what to do. We didn't have to improvise. On the other hand, there were people that were having to improvise a lot on the environmental problems. And they succeeded. They managed to solve those problems.
Yeah, I guess you never, when everything goes as planned, you don't appreciate how much of the pre-planning and how much of the work is done ahead of time. But even then, I guess after 11, was the urgency in, was it less in terms of inside NASA, in terms of it being a race? And so,
well, the race was won.
It was won, okay. And so it was just falling through with the rest of the missions as planned.
It was clear that the race was won. Well, they didn't even really complete all the missions as planned. Mm. They were curtailed. There were more advanced missions that had been on the books that were just chopped off at the end. They did not fly out the whole series of Apollo, which to me was a great disappointment, because those later missions would have been high inclination. They would have involved mapping portions of the moon that had not been visited, would have been much more challenging missions.
Yeah. Has there been missions, be it NASA or other countries or other things that you've seen that you've really enjoyed getting to see over the years, or things that you personally enjoy? You mentioned like some of the interplanetary stuff. Has there been any, I guess, knowledge gained by any missions since Apollo that you thought were really spectacular from a personal point of view?
Well, I think that all of these discoveries that have been made in the interplanetary stuff has been interesting. I just don't think that the public gets as engaged when there's not a human being that's directly involved.
Yeah, that's true. We're talking about some of the serious aspects of, you know, the human spaceflight program, but are there kind of funny or silly stories about working during that time that were, I don't know, maybe don't get covered or haven't been covered as much?
Well, I don't know if you'd think this is a silly story, but one of the oddities, well, I'm sure you all know that part of what happened there was that we were in this race against the Soviet Union, and the schedule on Apollo 8 was accelerated because of this fear that the Soviet Union was going to beat us. Part of the craziness of that time, or at least I thought it was a craziness, I had an assignment, and because it was classified, and I don't know if it's been unclassified, I can't really go into what it involved, but I had an assignment that I thought, somebody really thinks that this could happen? This is the craziest thing I've ever seen. And it was worry about the Russians beating us. And I was running all of this stuff. When I first got the assignment, I was told what it was, and I said, no, they are not going to do that, okay? I don't need to run a bunch of data. I don't need to spend the taxpayers' money to tell you, no, they are not going to do that, because they cannot do that.
I have an idea of what this could be, but I won't say.
I cannot, you know, they cannot do this. And as you know, they said, no, I mean, you know, you have to run the data to show them they can't do that. Okay, I'll run this data to show you that you cannot do this. But I, part of what went through my mind was I thought, you know, there are people who are earning a lot more money than I am who think that this needs to be done.
Yeah.
I'm sure that hasn't changed in politics today.
I mean, it was craziness. It was just craziness. The paranoia was what I felt. This is just pure paranoia that somehow or another the Soviet Union is going to find a way to do these crazy things and get there. And I, since then, I suppose because of what we see now about all the talk about disinformation campaigns, I can't help but wonder, was this part of a disinformation campaign? Or was this just pure paranoia on our side?
Yeah.
Or some combination of both.
Yeah, well, I mean, certainly it's interesting to look at, because again, this documentary shows so much of the American perspective and the American lens of everything. And, you know, now 50 years on, we get to benefit from sort of knowing more about all the different sides and things which were very much an American lens on things and things that were a Russian lens. Because the documentary starts out by saying, you know, Sputnik happened and then Yuri Gagarin happened and then it was really on. But of course, if you were viewing it through a Russian lens, it may be more like we did all these things and then there was the moon. So I think it's fascinating to sort of go into this documentary as a, I guess kind of as an investigative reporter of like seeing how things were portrayed and how that's affected how people tell this story to this day.
And that's the lens I definitely watched this documentary like with, right? This was American media covering it. And it's fascinating and it is a time capsule, but it is also through, like you said, Ariel, one perspective. And in looking at the range of how Apollo, whether it's 11 or the entire program, has been covered in popular media since, you know, between 50 years ago and now, you know, is there something that you feel hasn't been told yet or something you'd like to see or something you saw that you're waiting to be told?
Well, not really. I'm just awfully impressed by what has been unearthed. I had no idea that there was so much of this archival stuff laying around and that it would be dug up. And I'm not an expert at film or audio, but it's really impressive to see what kinds of things people have been able to do in terms of restoring the stuff and making it available. The first time I saw on a big screen the liftoff sequence, for example, it just really amazed me. I went to the liftoff of Apollo 13, actually, because I didn't go to work at the Space Center until they left the Earth's sphere of influence. So I had time to fly down there and then race to get home. And what I'm seeing now, okay, with this documentary, is the closest thing I've ever seen to actually being there. I mean, you really feel close to the thing and can feel the power of that rocket. It just, my heart started, you know, I started my heart racing. It was just amazing.
Yeah, I love that there's so much media right now around that and around that experience. As someone who didn't live through that time, but the whole reason I got into NASA in the first place was from watching a documentary about those launches and about, you know, so even though I didn't live through it, it's what inspired me to actually say, well, you know, maybe I should reach out to NASA. And a lot of it was watching people in mission control. And so I'm happy that they're showcasing you and showcasing more people in mission control, because at least for me, that was the start of my journey into NASA. For space exploration today, and I guess for, you know, young people today, you know, what's your advice for people who are coming of age in a different time in space exploration, about, I guess, you know, what would you do if you were, again, in your mid-20s and wanting to get involved in space exploration today?
Well, I'd probably be involved trying to get a job at JPL or one of their contractors, because that they seem to have their act most together. I understand that, you know, there's talk about going back to the moon 2024 or going on to Mars. I think that's wonderful. I would love to see that happen. I wish I could say I was optimistic. But one of the things I think has not really, I don't think anyone's really paid enough attention to, probably in this historically, is the role that Lyndon Johnson played. Because Lyndon was the one that got the money. There's just no way around that. All you have to do is look at the money and who was president and so forth. And it was Lyndon Johnson that got the money. And looking at that, in fact, just the other day, I was looking at that and I decided I need to go back and reread Cairo's book about Lyndon. So I started reading the fourth volume of his book. And I had forgotten how frozen Congress was at that time, and how he went in and there was no one around who knew more about how to pull the strings and push the levers at Congress to get money out of there. And I don't know if we would have been able to do Apollo if we had not had him as the president. JFK was a very charismatic guy. He was very photogenic, and he had the vision. But Lyndon Baines Johnson, as I said, he knew how to work the levers in Congress.
Yeah, and I mean, we're talking about the, in part, the percent of the federal budget that NASA used to be, which at the height of Apollo was 4%. Now it's about half of 1%.
Half of 1%.
Lucky even when it's that. And NASA has had relatively flat budgets lately that don't even keep pace with inflation.
And I have not seen anyone in the White House since Lyndon Baines Johnson was there who could push budgetary things through.
Mm-hmm.
No one, okay? So I don't know how you manage to go back to the moon in 2024 when you don't have the money.
Yeah.
It's just as much a technological problem as it is a political problem, mm-hmm. as it is a cultural problem, and all of those things, you know, the stars have to align, for good puns, for this thing to work, which makes you appreciate, you know, it's perspective that makes us appreciate looking back, because, you know, to your point, it's the willingness to fund something like this in the moment we feel today is much less than in retrospect. Maybe that's one of the reasons that celebrating an achievement like this, if we're going to do a takeaway.
Well, and of course, I mean, You always have to look at Lyndon Johnson in perspective and look at where the big centers were You know, it's no accident that the big centers were in Florida, Alabama, Texas. I mean, who had the senators with the seniority? It's a very political operation.
Yeah, which still affects us today.
Today, absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a lot. And, you know, the thing where I try and be optimistic on this is that NASA needs the funding, absolutely. Needs funding that even just keeps in pace with inflation. Where I try and be optimistic is to do big things now, like landing on Mars, requires international collaboration that didn't exist or wasn't as much a part of it 50 years ago. And so on one hand, it's hard to be optimistic with some of the future space plans. On the other hand, my optimism comes from if we do one day land a human on Mars, it will be because people had to come together at an unprecedented level to collaborate and actually share the load of the budget and the political will and the interest and everything.
I hope we will do that. I very much hope we will do that. I hope our government is able to get its act together enough to be able to collaborate.
Yeah.
And that's a real challenge for us.
Yeah. Other than money, what would you say space exploration sort of needs the most right now to be successful? Like, obviously money is a big component of it, but are there things where you feel like it needs an infusion of something other than money to really be where it should be?
Well, I think we need an enthusiasm from the public as well, because that drives the money to a certain extent. It places something on a priority. I'm hopeful that as people look back on what happened with Apollo 11 and the other parts of the Apollo mission, that they will regain an enthusiasm, that they'll recognize what an incredible technical achievement it was on the one hand, and that we can really do great things if we focus on it and if we put our efforts, our hearts, our minds, and our money behind it. We can solve these huge problems on the Earth. We can solve climate change problems. We can solve lots of things, but we have to focus.
Yeah, I think that's really, you know, the legacy of the Apollo missions is kind of showcasing what we can accomplish, and that things, on one hand, are so difficult, but yet are achievable. And yeah, it's just been an absolute treat to have you on the show today. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, I was happy to be here.
So, Ariel, let's get to the question. I know everyone's wondering, what was that task, that assignment you think that Poppy was tasked with that she could not talk about?
Okay, so this is full speculation because I don't know, and I don't want to get her in trouble. She did not tell us. She didn't even tell us off camera what that was. But my suspicion, based on some of the things I've read, is that it was about blowing up the moon. What do you think it was?
Unexpected destruction. Destruction was what I had in mind, because if she's calculating the return trajectories, you know, obviously without a moon or something impossible happening, yeah, the return trajectory would have to be recalculated. But yeah,
I think there were concerns, or at least I read that there were concerns that maybe they had the capacity to blow up the moon. So that's my best guess. Maybe I'm way off base here, but
I mean, and that totally is symptomatic of that, the fear and the urgency that made Apollo possible. You know, Poppy talked at the end about of this confluence of factors, with Lyndon B. Johnson being the one, you know, the pulling all the levers to get the funding. And we feel that because that's, I mean, the most believable thing in the science fiction disaster movies we've talked about is like urgency, right? Like Armageddon only happens, you know, Bruce Willis is sent to space because of urgency.
Yeah.
You know, Apollo only happens because they fear that Soviets would get there first. And that's something that is definitely lacking today.
Yeah, I mean, urgency is lacking, but, you know, and I all of her points are like spot on. I am with her on, you know, it is hard to be optimistic about a lot of the circumstances that things are in right now. But maybe it's my personality. I'm always looking for that optimistic angle of, you know, getting more people involved, and the fact that space exploration is no longer a monopoly and has opened up means there are opportunities to change. And, you know, it's not written. It's not all written out yet. And, you know, there's still a lot of amazing things that we can accomplish in our lifetimes if people get more involved and contribute to space exploration, even from their disciplines that maybe don't involve space exploration. But, you know, we're needing smart people like Poppy was in the 1960s. Today, we still need computer engineers. We still need really clever people to kind of swoop in and be like, I got this, the way Poppy does.
To be as prepared in that Apollo 13 moment, mm-hmm. that for her, she said it was, you know, from her opinion, her perspective, a huge success in the amount of preparedness that they had. And also what was striking to me was, you know, even, you know, we watch these documentaries and we feel a sense of awe because we didn't live through those moments. And in my head, it was always that the people who did live through those moments, maybe these documentaries would be, you know, they would be not as glamorous in comparison because they were there. Mm-hmm. But for her, it sounds like it did bring a lot of excitement and did show her parts of the world that she never got to see when she was just in mission control.
Yeah, to me, that's really the loveliness of documentary filmmaking is the fact that you can actually make something even more fantastic to experience through film, even though you're not living through it. The fact that knowing that we can watch something that gets Poppy more into the mode of what it was like on a global level, not knowing all those things, and get more excited about it. And the fact that we can have that same experience as her, even though we didn't live through it, I don't know. It's really heartwarming, and it's good to know that history can still affect us in such a profound way.
And that's one of the great things about this being the 50th anniversary. So many documentaries, so many pieces of media, so many stories coming out about that era. And this is just one of them. Again, it's called Apollo Missions to the Moon. It's on National Geographic, July 7th, which I believe is today. So please check that out. And please continue checking out Offworld. You can always find us if you just want to listen to us as a podcast. We're at tested.com/offworld or any of your podcast listening apps. And we'll be back next time with another episode.